This audio recording is under copyright protection, all rights reserved. Any duplication, transmission, or broadcast without permission is strictly prohibited by U.S. and international laws.
Welcome. Teaching boys and other kids who would rather be making forts all day. I titled this talk, and I worried that maybe, well, only people with boys would want to come. So I thought, well, maybe I should title it something different. But last year, I tell you, this was without a doubt the number one most popular convention talk everywhere in the country. We packed out every single room, whether it held 50 or 1,000 people. Everyone was fascinated. How many people have a child who is either a boy or a kid who would rather be making forts all day? Okay, so almost everybody falls into that category. But even if you didn't, this would be a profoundly enlightening talk for you. Because I'm going to do two things. One is I'm going to go over some of the neurophysiological differences between boys and girls and how they see differently, hear differently, handle stress differently, and process pain differently, all of which are activities involved in teaching. Part two of the talk, I'm going to go over everything I have learned and synthesized about motivation over my teaching career. I began my teaching as a violin teacher, and I assure you that a good chunk of the job of a violin teacher isn't teaching music to children, but coaching parents on how to successfully continue what is arguably one of the hardest things you can ask a young child to do, to play a musical instrument every day, consistently and happily at home. So a lot of what I developed here, I started thinking about long ago, and I'll share a few stories with you. So it's really the two part, the neurophysiological differences and then the science of motivation, science and art, I would say. We're going to have the four forms of relevancy, the three laws of motivation, and if time allows, the two secret weapons. Although one time I gave this talk and I forgot the last secret weapon. I just couldn't for the life of me remember what it was. But now I think I will remember. All right, so first, we will talk about this fascinating stuff, the difference between how boys and girls learn. I came across this information when I attended a schools conference in Atlanta. I was very privileged to be speaking there, along with another man by the name of Dr. Leonard Sachs, S-A-X, Dr. Leonard Sachs, who spoke about differences in sexes. And he wrote a book called Why Gender Matters. And I'm saying this slowly and carefully because I suspect many of you will want to read this book. You can also read about Dr. Sachs and his work at whygendermatters.com. Now, Dr. Sachs is a pediatrician by primary profession. And I believe it was a little more than a decade ago, he began to notice a very high number of mothers bringing in little boys with notes from the school saying, "We believe this child has an attention deficit issue. Would you please evaluate and prescribe an appropriate medication?" Dr. Sachs would then evaluate the child and determine that no, he seemed perfectly normal and healthy, and declined to prescribe medication. These same moms with the same boys would come back in a few weeks later with another note from the school saying, "No, we really, really do think this child would benefit from the medication. Please change your opinion and prescribe accordingly." And Dr. Sachs began to wonder if teachers in schools knew what doctors know about boys. and about the differences between boys and girls, which are very scientifically proven, documented, experiment after experiment, research after research has been done. And Dr. Sachs was aware of this because of his training in the medical field. So he was curious to know if teachers knew that most little boys do not hear sounds as soft as the sounds that most little girls can hear. Because really, if you can't hear well in a classroom, you might have an attention deficit issue, right? I mean, if I was in a classroom and I couldn't hear the teacher, or I could hear her some days but not others because there were other things going on, or I was sitting in a different place, or I could hear her sometimes when the barometric pressure was higher or lower, but I couldn't when it wasn't, or when I got too much sugar for my breakfast. See, human neurology is very sensitive. And the younger you are, the more sensitive it is. So Dr. Sachs went to the schools, and he started to ask the people in schools, teachers, counselors, student nurses, administrators, are you familiar with this research base? He discovered two things. Number one, nobody in any school had ever heard anything about that. Nobody. And number two, everyone he talked to took umbrage, took offense at the idea that boys and girls were not perfectly equal in every way. And so this set him on the path of collecting up more evidence and more research and organizing and presenting it in his book. And it is a tremendously important and valuable book. And he ended up founding an organization called the Association for Single-Sex Public Education, because he teaches that boys and girls can learn anything, right? There's no learning aptitudinal differences, but the method of teaching and the environment you create need to be different for optimal learning to occur. When he began, there were only 5 public schools in the entire country which had sex-segregated classrooms. Now there are over 500. I'm going to tell you just some of the fun, most interesting things I learned from Dr. Sachs in Atlanta. First, about hearing. Now, he says that boys and girls hear differently. Now, in order to understand this, we have to be careful that we're not making a fallacy of generalization. We are making a statistical and therefore valid generalization. Anytime you're going to do this, there will be a range. So certainly there are going to be some boys who hear better than some girls, right? But the majority will be true that most girls hear softer sounds than most boys. So, understanding that there are exceptions, I'm going to risk speaking in generalities so that we can understand what we're likely to come up against. Now, this business about males not hearing as well as females, I think all moms know this, don't you? Don't you have to say things louder and more often to the males around you? I mean, it's kind of normal just as a way of life, but we do have quite a bit of research to prove that even from birth, there is a large difference. One of the research studies that he cites was done with newborn children, and they can do this thing called cochlear response, where they can actually look at the cochlea and the auditory nerve and determine if the sound is causing any reaction. And they found that in newborns, most of the time, not all the time, but the great majority of the time, the girls' ears would respond physiologically to sounds that were 3 times softer than the softest sound that the boys could respond to. Another study he cited, which was of particular interest to me because I am a musician, involved premature infants and in a hospital in Florida and music. And they found that if you play music for premature infants, they will gain weight, grow better, and be released from the intensive care type of place sooner than if you don't play music, right? And I thought, well, that's very interesting. And Dr. Sack thought that was very interesting. But then he went to the primary data, the actual case studies, and he discovered that statistically that was true. However, in the premature babies, it was only the girls that made the difference. Statistically, in the music, the premature baby boys didn't have that same growth. Because, why? They perhaps couldn't hear it. Now, if you had cranked up the volume for those preemie babies, you might have been get them to gain the weight and get out of there faster too. So it was a fascinating study, but the primary data is even more revealing. With toddlers about that age, they can do a thing called acoustic brain response, acoustic brain resonance, imaging, acoustic brain imaging, where you can actually take a non-intrusive picture of brain activity, right? And so that you know someone's hearing something and brain cells are firing off. And here they found that in toddler age kids, the girls would respond to sounds up to 10 times softer than the softest sound that boys could respond to, right? And then even with adults, a study was done evaluating how much of the brain is used when listening, and they found that women, when listening to audiobooks, use both sides of their cortex. Men only use their dominant hemisphere, which for most of us will be our left brain. Of course, I think, again, most moms know this, that the men use only half their brain much of the time. I don't know why it is this way, but it is very revealing. I have known this also in teaching children. I have known that when you've got boys in a class, if you speak louder and get closer to them, they will respond better. I've also noticed that if you speak loud and get close to girls, they pull back. They're almost afraid. Yeah. And a lot of times you'll get a case where the daughter will go to the mother and say, "Dad was yelling at me." And the mom will say, "Why are you yelling at her?" And say, "I wasn't yelling, I was talking to her." Right? And so this is something that we can understand. If you had to teach in a classroom, if you had to organize a classroom, right, I would either put all the boys in the front and the girls behind them, or I'd put all the boys on one side and the girls on the other, and I'd stand next to the boys. And I had a very interesting experience when I was in Florida. I had a chance to teach in a school that had sex-segregated classes. I was doing demonstration writing classes, and I tell you, I thought I had died and gone to teacher heaven. Because I taught a group of fifth grade boys, and you know what? It was a blast. I was loud, I was in their face, I was falling on the table, I'm waving my arm, I'm all over the place. The kids were like, "This is interesting." And that's the way I would normally teach boys. But if you do that too close to a girl, she clams up. And then I got to teach a class of seventh grade girls. That was easy too. You just stay in one place. You talk very nicely. You write. And when they get distracted by the sound, you just go, "Come on back over here. We're talking right now here about this. Isn't this lovely?" Okay, fine. You smile at them real big. And they're happy as a clam. And it wasn't until that experience that I realized how hard I had to work. Because if you talk loud enough to a boy to hear you and be engaged, that girl right next to him will be threatened by it. And so I'm constantly having to adjust myself from being loud to soft to animated to calm. I thought, wow, that's hard work. I did this instinctively, but now I understand much more the science behind it. We hear differently. We also see differently. Males and females have very different visual processing apparatus in their nervous system. Now, I've kind of always known that my wife and I see things very differently. But the physiology of it is fascinating. Dr. Sachs explained, and I am not a scientist, so it was a little bit of a stretch for me. He did a great job of presenting it, and I understood it better from reading the book. But to give you the short version, the optic nerve that connects to the retina has two main types of cells that connect. M cells, which are the big ones, and P cells, which are the small ones. Dr. Sachs said they have fancy scientific names, but you don't really need to know them because even the scientists themselves just call them M cells and P cells. But as you recall, perhaps from high school biology, there are two types of light processors in the retina. You've got the rods and the cones, correct? And they actually process different information. The rods process speed, distance, and direction information. The cones process color and texture. Now, in the optic nerve, when it connects to the retina, the M cells, the bigger ones, connect to the rods, and the P cells, the smaller ones, connect to the cones. Right? Now, guess what? Males have much more M cells and fewer P cells. Females have more P cells and fewer M cells, which means that children actually perceive the world differently. Speed, motion, distance, and direction are more vivid and clear information coming into little boys' brains. And color and texture are more vivid information, more intense, coming into little girls' brains. You can see this very obviously if you look at a room full of little kids drawing, right? Because if you go into, say, a classroom with five, six, 7-year-olds, the boys are almost always attempting to draw verbs, right? How many of you have got boys who have guns with bullets coming out and flying across the page, right? And girls are almost always drawing nouns. They're drawing things. It's because they actually see those more clearly. And what happens is, if you don't know this and you're attempting to help teach a child to draw, right? And your typical teacher who might have had a class or two in teacher's college on teaching art to young children, right? She'll come over and she'll say, "Oh, Billy, that's a nice drawing. What is it?" Right? And Billy, very excitedly, will say, "Well, it's a rocket ship, and it took off from the Earth, and then it crashed into this asteroid, and it fell into all these pieces, and it's careening through and burning as it goes in the atmosphere." Very scientific, 7-year-old. And the teacher says, "Oh, well, that's nice. Now, you know, next time when you draw a rocket, could I show you how to put the fins on? And then you could put, you know, the cap, and we'd know that it was a rocket. And you might like to use a few more colors," because, of course, Johnny has done his whole drawing in one color, probably black. Right? And then she goes up and she says, "Oh, Sally, I love how you've got this beautiful log cabin with the smoke coming out, the red brick chimney, and the sun shining in the sky, and the flowers in front, and the happy family all lined up with smiling faces. And I love how you've used all the colors. That's good. Keep doing that." Because she's trying to apply the principles that she thinks would help each child. But it doesn't take very long until little Billy discovers, right, the teacher likes that and doesn't like this.
Right.
And unassisted, he will at some point quit drawing in public, and then he'll quit drawing at all. I actually remember the day I said to myself, I don't know how old I was young, "I'm not going to draw anymore. I just decided I'm not going to draw. I don't like drawing. I don't ever like what I draw. Nobody likes what I draw. I'm just going to stop doing it." And I think my mom tried to overcome that by getting me an art teacher, but it was just awful experience. Why? Because what do you draw? Things. What do you see? Action. It's fascinating. It even carries over into writing. Study done at the University of Virginia analyzing student writing. Now, these are adults, right? College and university students analyzing the most powerful descriptors. In other words, what are the most powerful or significant words in every sentence? And categorizing these statistically, and what do you think they found? In the men, the most powerful descriptors were verbs and adverbs. And with the women, the most powerful descriptors were the nouns and adjectives. And almost all the books written on how to be a good writer, if you go to the library and look on a book on how to write well, They're almost all by men. Strunk, White, Zinsner, right? And you pull them off, and what do they always say? Verbs, verbs, verbs. Use the verbs, right? I wonder if there was a book written by a woman on how to write well, it might not have different advice. But this carries very directly into what I do. Number one, we have tremendous success with our writing program with boys. And it may be because they watch me and I'm funny and animated and there's that element. But I believe it's because one of the very first things we teach is this L-Y adverb. Most teachers would think, and it's kind of logical, you should teach adjectives first and then adverbs, because really an adjective is the root of an adverb, right? Beautiful, beautifully, loud, loudly. Fact is, we teach the L-Y word first, and I believe we have more success because it's something that the boys, and in fact all children, tend to be more motion-based creatures. But in particular, the boys can relate to this thing. And if you say to a boy, hey, son, this is a pretty nice story. Would you like me to help you add in a little more detail? He might say, nope. But if you say, son, this is a really great story. How about if we add in a bit more action? He'll say, cool, yeah, let's do that. That sounds like fun, right? And so we can understand this. So for teaching art, teaching writing, and you understand the visual differences, it helps a lot. Of course, you all know the whole idea of men and women like different kinds of directions. Dr. Sachs, I think it was just for fun, but he cited this study where they got groups of college students and they gave two types of directions to get somewhere. One were the absolute directions, right? Go north 3 blocks, turn east, go 1.5 blocks, turn north through the alley, blah, 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 right? Absolute directions. And then they gave relative directions, landmark-based directions. Go until you see the white picket fence with the large oak tree. Turn right and then go down until you see the fire hydrant next to the Mustang, then turn left, right? And so they had these two tests. Well, of course, they found that the men got there faster with the absolute directions than they did with the landmark, and the women got there faster with the landmark than they did the absolute. What was interesting was that the women did better with the absolute than the men did with the landmark. Because if the men miss the landmark, they just keep going. The other thing I've noticed is this whole thing about color and texture. I am very convinced I don't see it like my wife sees it. I came home from a trip once, and I walked into my own bedroom, and I looked around and I thought, something is different, right? And I was standing there, and she walked in, and she said, do you notice anything different? And I said, well, you cleaned up. Wrong answer. The fact is, and she said, no, I painted the walls. She had actually changed the color of the room, which evidently before had been some kind of off-whitish thing, to what it apparently is now, according to her, is some kind of off-bluish thing. But I'll tell you, I could have lived the whole rest of my life in that house and never figured out that she'd actually changed the color of the walls. Why? I don't care. I don't look at it. I don't notice it. We were building this house. We're remodeling the house. And she had these tiles, right? She had these 3 tiles that we had to choose which one we want for the bathroom floor. And so she says, which one do you like? And I looked at them and I said, sweetheart, I really don't care. This didn't work well because she takes it personally, you know, like, well, I always have to make all these decisions and you're just not involved and engaged with it, like you don't love me or something. Absolute truth is, I could not tell the difference between these 3 tiles. They were all just tiles with patterns. And to this moment, I've lived in this house 3 or 4 years now with these tiles. I couldn't describe them to you. I think they're some kind of brownish marble thing, but I don't notice it. I don't perceive that information, do you see? So it helps us understand the children a little better, and then it helps them understand each other, and it helps my wife understand me, and vice versa. Another fascinating area is stress. Men and women handle stress very differently. And there is a misnomer, a misunderstanding that many people have about stress and animals' response, the physiological response to stress. Most of us heard at some point that fight or flight, right? Have you heard that one? So under stress, then you would have a fight or flight response. Guess what? That is only true in male animals. Female animals have a very different response, and the reason we learned it was because a few decades ago, whenever we did learn it, the current research that had been done a few decades before that had been done only with male animals. Originally, they did these types of experiments only with male animals. Why? Because male animals don't have hormonal cycles that can disturb and delay your research. Fact is, female animals and female people handle stress very differently. I'll give you the quick rundown. In males, stress is activating the sympathetic nervous system, which causes an increase in heart rate, an increase in blood flow. It is regulated by standing and moving. It raises the body temperature, right? Which is your fight or flight. You're getting ready now. You're hyped up to fight or to get out of there. However, in females, the opposite is true. The initial response to stress is the parasympathetic nervous system, which actually causes a decrease in blood flow, a decrease in heart rate, a lowering of body temperature, and is regulated by sitting or lying down. And you have to go beyond a certain threshold of stress before you activate the sympathetic response in females. Because the females, instead of fight or flight, will either tend, befriend, or hide, camouflage, disappear. Right? Which makes a lot of sense, because you're not going to go running away or killing yourself and leaving your young unattended if you can get away with not being seen, not being heard, not being important enough. So there's that. Calming down. It also explains my children perfectly. Because my son, when he is upset, when he is stressed, when something has done something that he does not like, or he's having to do something, everybody in the house knows it. Right? That's not fair. She was mean. I don't like that. You're like, calm down. It's not such a big deal. Right? When the girls are upset, first you have to find them. Right? Now they're usually in their bed or on a couch, you know, and they've got the blanket pulled over their head. It could be 80 degrees, they've still got the blanket over their head, right? And you lift it up and you say, is something wrong? No, leave me alone. Can I help you? No, just leave me alone. Is there something that happened you could tell me about it? No, I just don't want to talk about it, leave me alone. You're like, okay, fine. Get their mother, you know. Now, is it possible that school or study can be stressful? Absolutely. Dealing with a hard thinking problem, a hard writing task, a hard math problem, it can be stressful. And when you say to a boy, sit down and do your math, you may be giving him bad advice. Because if he can handle stress better by standing up, you might switch it and say, stand at the counter and do your math. I know this is true. I absolutely do think better when I'm standing up. And so Dr. Sachs tells this story of how there's a school that successfully gender segregated their classrooms, and they took their first grade and their second grade, combined them and made an all-boys 1-2 and an all-girls 1-2. I mean, this is a bold move to make. If you believe what you're doing, though, the results can be phenomenal. And he told the story, he went to this one school where a teacher had doubled the rate of progress in the standardized testing among this group of 1-2 boys. And he talked a lot about the environment that the man created for this group of kids. And he said he the teacher very wisely made chairs optional. He said, you can use the chairs if you want, but you don't have to. And when he visited the class, the chairs all lined up against the wall. And the boys were all kind of hunched over at their desk, you know, doing their work, dancing around. And he said if they weren't hunched over their desk, they were caved in under, secret agent style, you know, on the floor doing their work. What is the primary function of the ear?
Not hearing. Balance. Balance is the primary function of the ear.
And when you have young children, right, and they are developing their whole auditory balance system, if you say to them, sit up and listen, you may be asking them to do two things which they cannot do simultaneously. And I noticed with my preschool kids, whenever they were actually listening to me, their whole center of gravity would drop down. Some of them would go almost prone. They'd be on like this. Like this. Why? Because they didn't have to balance, right? If you're like this, you can hold your body without having to work too hard. If you're like this, you could balance, but you can't listen, right? So that's why I have become much more relaxed about the posture of children. And if I see them slumped down in their chair, I understand maybe why they're doing that. Right? It could be that they need that position to have better brain function. Temperature is a huge one as well. Dr. Sachs claims that there's 6 degrees of temperature difference between the optimal learning temperature for boys and girls. He claims the optimal learning temperature in the environment for boys is 68 to 69 degrees, and that the optimal learning temperature for girls is 73 to 74 degrees. And that's a pretty big difference. And why? It's because of the stress handling. If your body temperature goes up, right, your stress handling, right, needs a cooler environment to deal with it. If your body temperature going down, your stress handling, and you're a girl, you need a warmer temperature to deal with it, right? So in a classroom, you can imagine, if it's too hot in the room, the boys are sitting there like, right? And if it's too cold, the girls will be like, it is too cold to even think in here. They'd be very distracted. Anyway, so I can understand pain. Last one, and then we'll go to the motivation stuff. This is so fascinating. Men and women handle pain very differently. Very differently. This study was done at a university, and it, in part, is a lesson on why, if someone offers you $100 to take part in a research study, be very suspicious and careful, because the study was like this. They inserted a balloon into a part of your body where you should not have balloons inserted. Then they expanded the balloon until it was very painful, and the subject said, stop! And then they took a quick snapshot of blood flow and brain activity. And what did they find? 100% of the men, pain caused an increase of blood flow to the brain. 100% of the women, pain caused a decrease of blood flow to the brain. This was not overlap, this was an absolute. Well, it kind of makes sense, because men, traditionally, survival, have been out hunting, fighting, working, getting hurt. They've got to keep going even if they get hurt. And you'll have soldiers who said, yeah, I got hit, and the pain kind of clarified my brain, knew exactly what to do, right? Dr. Sachs says he has never in his life heard a woman say, pain clarified my brain. Because let's face it, if women could actually remember childbirth, they would never do it again and the world would depopulate. You've got to get fuzzy at that moment, or you'd just swear it off forever and there'd be no replacement population, right? So it kind of makes sense, and yet, it explains a few things. Number one, it explains why if you don't let boys hurt each other, they will hurt themselves on purpose. They will inflict pain. In fact, I remember being a kid biting yourself Any of you guys ever do that? I remember biting myself. Just why? I don't know. Cool teeth marks, whatever. It was just that pain. It was something good. And even today, when I'm driving and I'm sleepy, which is frequent, my method of staying awake is to slap myself as hard as I possibly can on my face many times. My wife will never do this, but I can really hurt myself, and then I can wake up for a few minutes and keep driving. My wife, she could never do this. She turns on like old bad rock music or something and sings along to the hits of the 70s. But it's fascinating that the pain actually helps me in this way, but she can't relate to it at all, right? And my son's like this too. And it also helps when you explain to your boys and girls about each other. And you say, look, son, your sister is a girl. She processes pain neurologically very different from you. She does not like being hit, punched, wrestled, or squeezed. Because he thinks that she wants to experience what he wants to experience, which is to be hit, punched, wrestled, and squeezed. And then you say to the sister, you say, look, he is a boy. He kind of likes the feeling of being hurt. You have to understand that and just calmly put him away and remind him that you are not, right? And you can teach these kids, and then they can understand each other a little bit. As I mentioned to you, I spent most of my adult life, first half of my career, I was a violin teacher, and I had to come up with ways to help children continue to do hard things day after day. And then as I moved into the teaching world and the homeschooling world, and especially the teaching of writing, which is a hard thing for many children, and we want them to do it day after day, I began to look for the transference of my thinking and the development of how do you get kids to do this? And what motivates people? So when I look at myself, I look at our kids, I look at my children, I look at your children, I look at writing, I look at music, I look at the hardness of motivating, and I come up with these theories. So these are really all my own theories here. I'm not basing it on anybody else. But I have identified the one factor that seems to make learning easy, and without it, makes learning impossible. And the factor, I have termed it relevancy. Relevancy. If something is relevant, meaningful, significant, important, interesting to you, it's easy to learn, wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
And if it is not relevant, if it is not meaningful, interesting, or significant to you in some way, it is hard to learn. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm.
So I want to look at relevancy, but I believe there are different types of relevancy. So I've identified four categories, and we will go through them best to worst. The very best form of relevancy, the most effective and highest form of relevancy, is intrinsic relevancy. Intrinsic relevancy is when something is interesting to you because it's interesting to you. It just is. You have an intrinsic draw, a God-given interest, a biological interest, perhaps an early childhood environmental interest, whatever. You're just fascinated with it. Now, I am of the opinion that you will never learn, you will never study, you will never even begin to cover all the bases and learn everything you think you should. People come to me at a convention and say, well, I'm doing this, 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 and this, and I want to be sure I'm covering the bases. I say to them, forget it. That's stupid. You'll never cover all the bases. It's a bad expression. You don't even want to try to do it, because if you did cover all the bases, you would be a mile wide and half an inch deep. You would have learned a little bit about nothing. Instead, I try to encourage people to go more in depth, because it's how you learn. I'm totally convinced it's how you learn something far more valuable than what you learn. And then the stuff we use is just stuff. So here's my point. You will never learn everything there is to learn about everything anyway. So don't worry. Forget about it. It doesn't matter that much. Capitalize on intrinsic relevancies, and you will get more learning done. Example, practical example. Let's say you had a certain amount of time, and you wanted to learn something. And you said, well, I've got a certain amount of time, and we can study edible plants of North America or medieval weaponry. Okay, you've got a boy. You give him a choice. What's he going to go for? Absolutely, the medieval weaponry. Now, you may sit there and say, but wait a minute. I think the study of the edible plants of North America would be much more useful, because if you were lost and you knew what you could eat, you could avoid dying and all that garbage, right? But let's face it, you never know when making a catapult might come in handy. So you capitalize on intrinsic relevancy. You allow children to pursue their interests within a range of what's acceptable, and you'll get more enthusiastic learning. All right, so that's the best, intrinsic. There are certain things I study because they are fascinating to me. There are other things I flat out do not pay attention to because I think they're a stupid waste of time. And that is one of the great things about being an adult, right? I can study what I want to.
Yep.
Now, the next thing, the next form of relevancy is one notch lower. It's not quite as powerful, but it is a very good one. And this is what I have termed, actually my daughter Genevieve gave me this one, inspired relevancy. Her argument was, well, you may not be interested in something, but people can inspire you to be interested. And it's a very high form of relevancy because it's connected with mentorship in a way. You may not have a particular interest in something, but someone who you respect or love or like to hang with does have an interest. And therefore you catch it, right? There's that feeling of contagion and enthusiasm, right? Little Billy, you suggest to Little Billy, you say, well, Billy, how about if we do stamp collecting? Billy says, nope, not interested. He said, but it's interesting, really. No, no, thanks. Now, Billy goes over to his friend Joey's house. Now, Joey is collecting stamps, and so he's showing Billy, and he goes, okay, this is from Belize, and this is a really old stamp from the Soviet Union, when before it was actually Russia. And this stamp, this is worth $5, this one little stamp. And here's this like first day issue thing that's really cool. Billy comes home and goes, Mom, I gotta do stamp collecting. Well, where did this interest come from? Inspired relevancy. Good teachers can do this. They inspire relevancy. They say, all right, guys, today we are going to study nematodes. You will not believe how fascinating this is, because nematodes are a whole category of animal, and some of them, you know what happened? You cut them in half and it can grow into two separate creatures. I tell you, nematodes, and they're all over the place. There's the itty bitty bitty ones and the huge, huge big ones. I think we're gonna have a great time with nematodes. Are you ready? Right? And if you've done it right, the kids are like, okay, fine. Sounds good to me, let's go. Right? I think that people are very excited about their discipline. Can do this, right? And you meet someone who's crazy about science, you get interested and excited. You get someone who's just doing time teaching government because they'd rather be out coaching the football team, right? You're not gonna get all that interested from it. Do you see? And so that is why I know for a fact there are certain things I should never teach my children. One of them would be science. I personally hate science. I find it boring, and unless there's some connection with education, I find it completely a waste of my time. Now, does that mean I think it's worthless for everybody? Does that mean I don't want my children to learn it? No. What it does mean, however, is that I won't be a very good person to pick up a biology book and try to do biology with my daughter. What should I do? Find someone who loves science, as in crazy about it, and send her to them. All right, third form of relevancy. This is lower. This is a little bit lower. It's still effective. It's something we often have to resort to. And it is what I would call contrived relevancy. This is not interesting, and there's nobody around here who's going to make it interesting. So what do we do? We make it into a game. Give you an example. Sometimes it's a very small shift, right? Language workbook, page 72. Find all the prepositional phrases. Oh, identify and underline all the prepositional phrases in this paragraph. Yuck, blah, eh. That's a completely irrelevant, meaningless, tedious, and not worthwhile activity for about 99.999% of all English speakers on earth. But yet, there it is. Sometimes the shift is very small. Watch. Here is a paragraph. There are 16 prepositional phrases hidden in this paragraph. Find them all, and you win. It's a whole different world. I am a boy, I couldn't care less about prepositional phrases, but I like to win. And if you can set it up so that I can win, I'll play your dumb game, because I want to win it, and maybe I'll notice something about prepositional phrases in the process. You with me on this? Now, games are essentially economic systems, right? Where you're basically saying, if you play, there's a cause and effect here. There's a result. If you win, there's something good, and if you lose, something bad, right? So essentially, to work, a game has to be an economic system. And so there are certain rules you've got to follow when you create games. The first rule is you have to be able to win the game or you will not play, right? Casinos work on this system, right? If everybody always lost whenever they went to a casino, their business would collapse because nobody would go. However, if you can win some of the time, even though you lose most of the time, you're still willing to play. I mean, some people are, right? Why? Because there's a potential for winning. So if you set up a game where you have winners and losers, right, then you're in a dangerous position because not everybody can win, so not everybody's going to play. I'll give you a perfect example. I watched my wife do this with my son and my daughter. They're 3 years apart, and she had little flashcards she had made of all the sight words, you know, the words that you just have to, you can't sound them out, you just have to know them, and they're all the ones that come up all the time. So she had this little game going where she showed the word, right, and if you could read it, you got the word. Right? But if you couldn't read it in 3 seconds, then the other person got the chance to read it. And then they'd get the word, and whoever had the most words at the end would win. Well, what do you think happened? My little daughter was winning this game hands down, right? And she'd show, and my son would get all stressed, and he wouldn't be able to do it. And then she'd do it, and she'd belt it out. And pretty soon, she's got like 8 words, he's got one. What happened? He quit. He walked off, had a little tantrum. I hate that. Why? Well, because he knew he couldn't win this game. There's no possibility. Why would you play a game you couldn't win? So I said to her, okay, wrong system. If you want to do this, you've got to set it up so they can both win. Not against each other, but against themselves, right? And so the way to do it would be to say, okay, you get to read the card, right? If you can't read it, then it goes back in the pile. Don't give it to the other person. Then you get to read this one, and there's 10 cards, and if you all get four, if you both get at least four, then you can win, and you get your prize, which, you know, 10 minutes piggyback ride or whatever. Of course, now it's down to about two. As I get older, the piggyback rides get shorter. But, you know, whatever prize you've got going, but you've got to be sure you can win. Okay, that's principle number one of contriving a game. Principle number two is, if you're going to set up a motivational system, it has to have both a potential gain and a potential loss. If it's only one-sided, you can get into trouble very quickly. If you say to the child, okay, here's a hard, miserable thing you've got to do, okay? If you will do it, you can have this reward. Now, you're in a very dangerous position because the kid can make a decision and say, nope, not worth it, right? So then you would say, well, okay, if you'll do it, you can have this reward. And you go up a notch. You have now just created a game you do not want to play called How High Can We Bid Up Mom Before She Gets Angry and, you know,
makes me do it anyway, right?
So you don't ever want to get in a bidding war there. Okay? So you have to also have a potential negative consequence. However, if you only have a negative consequence, then you're really moving into a very bad place because you've got a hard, difficult thing and you say, look, you have to do this hard, difficult thing or you will suffer this negative consequence. Well, the kid could very easily evaluate the situation and say, well, I suffer if I do, I suffer if I don't. I'm just going to suffer any way you look at this, so I think I'll just go eat worms and die. And you get very depressed. So if you have a positive and a negative, you've got an economic system that will work. I'll give you a couple very practical examples. One of the things I did with all of my students and the violin students was the 100 Days Perfect Practice and Listening Challenge. And the way this works is when you sign up for it, you get a sheet with 100 squares, and you can draw pictures or stickers or put X's or whatever. And if you practice your violin at least a little bit every day, and you listen to your CD at least a little bit every day, you put an X, and if you do 100 days without missing a single day, you win, and you get the prize. And I usually set it up for the parents that it's some kind of award. I give them a certificate, but then the parents have to do something. You know, so for some people, it was $50 for the video game you want to buy. Or for other people, it was you get to go out, you know, to dinner with dad, just the two of you. Or someone else said, well, we'll have a pizza, ice cream, and movie party with your friends. Whatever. It's got to be a big enough carrot that the kid says, yeah, I'm willing to try for that goal, right? And then you say there are a couple rules here. Number one, if you miss a day, you lose it all and you have to start all over again. That's the potential negative consequence, right? The other rule is mom can't remind you. You have to remember on your own. And if you don't, her hands are tied. If she reminds you, the whole thing is invalid. You got to start over. Okay? So what usually happens is the kid will say, okay, I'll play the game. And they'll start out, right? And they'll get 7, 8, 9 days, usually a week and a half or so. And then they'll miss a day. They'll forget, or they won't do it, or they'll get too busy, whatever. And they're like, oh! Right? Have to start all over. You throw the thing away, get a new chart up, back to day one, right? But you can still win. You haven't eliminated the possibility of winning. You've just suffered the negative consequence, right? So then the kid would usually get up to 20-some days. And some of them fail again, and others of them have a close call. Almost everybody has a close call where they come home at 11 o'clock and dad carries them in, puts them in bed, and they wake up at 11:45 and go, oh no, I haven't played my violin yet today. And they quickly get up, play Go Talent, ready for him, go back to sleep. Right? Or maybe they fail and start all over again, okay? But then you get a kid who's up to about 70-some days, there is no force on earth that would prevent them from playing their violin because they're so heavily invested and the negative consequence is too great and the positive consequence is still worth it, do you see? And then once you get up to 100 days, you say, let's go, double stakes. 200 days nonstop, right? And I've had kids go. I had one girl, she got over 1,200 days of practicing her violin and listening to her CD without missing a single day. And by the time you're up in the hundreds, you know, 400 or 500, you just keep going out of sheer pride, you know? Because how many people can do one thing every single day for years? That's a hard thing to do. And of course, it's got all of its collateral benefits, but it's an example of a game. Another application, positive and negative. If any of you had a child who wrote a story or a paper and they thought, well, it's got to have spelling errors, right? You've got a story or paper with spelling errors, and you look at it and you say, I know this child could fix this if they tried. Have you ever had that experience? So you could say, oh, you missed so many words. I didn't even spell this. Do better. Ugh, horrible task. Instead, you count them up and go, okay, there's 9 words. And you say to the kid, you know what? I see 8 words, which I believe you know how to spell. And remember, there was 9, but you say 8, which is not a lie because there are 8. And you say, I see 8 words. I believe you could find and fix all these words. So here's the deal. If you find and fix all 8, I give you $1. If you find and fix 7, you get 50 cents. If you find and fix 6, you can still win a quarter. And if you find and fix 5, it's a break-even deal. If you only find and fix four, then you owe me a quarter. If you find and fix three, you owe me 50 cents. If you can only find one or two, you're going to have to pay me a dollar because I'm going to then have to do your work, and I'm not going to do your work without getting paid. Now, you've created a whole new game called Get Mom's Dollar. And it doesn't matter whether it's dollar or points or whatever. The kid will work hard, work an hour, and type the whole thing into the computer and run the spell checker just to find, you know, just to find them. Because he wants that thing. You see? It's a positive and negative. All right? So when you contrive a game, be sure it follows these two guidelines. Fourth form of relevancy is what we want to avoid at all costs. It is enforced relevancy. Now, quickly, let's move on to the three laws of motivation. It's really one law with two corollaries. The law and the corollaries. The first law is children like to do what they can do. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
Actually, that's the first thing that comes out of their mouth once they can say a few words. It's, Ma, look at me. Look what I can do. Children love to do what they're good at. Actually, it's true for all of us, isn't it? Right? I have one daughter. She's an excellent cook. She loves to cook. She'll always cook. She's crazy about cooking. Why? Because she is a good cook, which has its ups and downs for me, right? I love doing this. Why? Because I can, right? I feel like I'm good at it. I love doing this. My wife would not. She would hate doing this. She's, you know, she has this fear of standing in front of groups of people, right? I love it. So I like to do what I can do. Now, children are like this also. If you let them do what they can do and get better at what they can already do, they get better and they're motivated to do it because they can. Do you see? Corollary number two. Children want to do what they think they can do. My son wants to jump off the roof. Why? Because he thinks he can do it. Now, my wife does not want him to jump off the roof. But he wants to. In fact, to be quite honest, he has jumped off the roof. And therefore, he's moved from wanting to do it into a liking to do it. We just try to keep this a secret from his mother. Right? I want to speak in a coliseum with 10,000 people. I haven't done it, but I want to do it. Why? Because I believe I could. There are definitely people who would not want that opportunity. But I do. I want to be on Oprah. Why? Because I think I could change the world if someone would get me on Oprah. A lot of people wouldn't, you see? So I want to do it because I think I can. Children are just like this. Third law, corollary, children hate to do and will refuse to do what they think they cannot do. And by the way, it doesn't matter at all whether you think they can do it or not. That's completely irrelevant. It's whether they think they can do it. This is true for us as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
I flat out absolutely refuse to get on a snowboard ever again in my life. I won't do it. The time I tried, it was so awful, miserable, painful, humiliating, sore, wet, degrading, awful experience. I flat out won't do it. There's nothing short of a very good-sized five-digit number with a dollar sign attached that would cause me to even entertain the idea of getting on a snowboard again. Now, my children, of course, think this is ridiculous. And they talk to me like this, come on, Dad, it's fun. I'm sure you could do it. You really would have fun. And once you get the hang of it, all you got to do is try, and then you can learn. Anybody can do it. Come on, let's go. Totally ineffective. Right? I have flat out decided that I will refuse to ever do snowboarding or skiing ever again. So they all go to the snow and I go work somewhere. Because I don't even want to see it. I hated it so much. Now, all of their cajoling doesn't change my reality, but how often have we been on the other side of that? Right? And you've got the kid and he says, I can't do this. And you say, come on now, I'm sure you could do it. If you just apply yourself and try, I know you can do it. Totally irrelevant. If the kid believes he can't do it, he won't. And he'll flat out refuse, and he'll contrive any way to get out of doing it, right? And so the trick then, if you can swing it, if you wanted to have a perfectly motivated, 100% all the time motivated child, you'd do it this way. You'd spend 60 to 80% of your time letting him do what he can do and get better at it, and 20 to 40% of the time letting him try to do what he thinks he can do and giving you enough help to be successful, and 0% of your time asking him to do something which he believes he cannot do. What causes someone to believe they can't do something? Failure. That's the only thing that would cause it. Failure or old age. But children don't suffer old age. The only thing that would cause them to believe they can't do something is failure. And that's the problem. I'll give you a very practical example. When I do spelling with my son, spelling is not his strong point. And when I started this verbal spelling a few years ago, I used the same word every time. Every day we'd start, I'd use the same word, day after day, month after month. The word was stick, right? And I'd say, okay, son, we're going to do spelling. Spell stick. Now, we'd done this 100 times, but he still had to think, right? S-T-I-C-K. Okay? Why was he willing to do that? Because he'd done it. He could do it. He knew he could do it, right? So then I go to the next word, and what kind of word am I going to choose? A really close one, right? Like stack. Okay, now stack. Remember, it's very much like stick, except instead of an I, there's an A. You got it? Okay, now he's willing to try that. S-T-A-C-K. You got it. Cool. Why was he willing to try stack? Because he believed he could do that. If I had said, okay, son, the next word is beautiful, he would say to me, no. I'd say, come on, I'm sure you can do it. Just sound it out. Give it your best shot. It's not that hard. Beautiful. Come on, give it your shot. If he didn't believe he could spell it, he would flat out refuse. And he would pull any tantrum, any kind of what you might interpret as rebellion. But it wasn't rebellion. He's a good kid. But it was that problem, he believed he couldn't do it. Or he didn't believe that he could, same difference. So those are the three laws, and if you apply them, they work. I know this. So finishing up with the two secret weapons. Secret weapon number one is an economic system of emotional principle. I learned this one from my teacher, Dr. Suzuki. Suzuki used money as a metaphor for a lot of things. And he talked about when you teach a child, you need to build up their emotional bank account high enough so that you can live off the principal. Right? You understand the idea. Right? So if you have $1 million in the bank, right, and you get $50,000 a year, and you can live on $50,000 a year, you can keep living and still have $1 million in the bank. But if you give $1 million in the bank and you get $50,000 a year, but you live on $100,000 a year, then in 10 years you're gonna have no money. Actually, much shorter than that. So Suzuki's idea is you build up the emotional principle in the bank account of the child, and then when you correct them by you're withdrawing from that account, and you have to keep the principal high enough. Because does anybody really like correction? I don't really. Do you? Do you like it when you need someone to say, you messed up, you did it wrong, you could have done it better, I'm so sorry, but you're going to have to do it again? Do you like that? No, I hate it. But I endure it. However, it's hard. It's especially hard when it comes from people I love the most. I don't know why. And so it kind of withdraws a bit. Are you with me on this? And in violin teaching, I tell you, it is so easy to get on the negative swing. The kid comes in and you say, oh, you know, last week we learned how to keep your feet, and if you would please put them back where they belong, and remember you hold the violin this way, and this wrist has to be down, you keep these curves swinging, and I told you about keeping that bent thumb on your bow and the little finger round and relaxed, and would you please get that violin up on your shoulder and turn your head the way it's supposed to be? If you taught that way, how long would you have anybody want to play the violin? Less than one lesson. So what I've learned is that correction and criticism has to be done very carefully if you want a motivated child. Because if you do too much of it too fast, you get demotivated people. So I would actually keep score. I realized, and Suzuki suggested that the interest rate is 10%. Of course, now it's much lower, getting lower every day. But if you had a 10% interest rate, you'd have to say 10 positive things before you could pull out one negative. You with me? And I used to keep score. I would count on my fingers secretly while I was teaching. And you'd get a girl come in, right? And she would come in, and I would know I have to say things that are sincere and building up her emotional bank account. Because she's been in school all day. She's exhausted, probably didn't eat right, having hormonal problems, disturbed friends. Everything in her life is tough. I mean, let's face it, whoever would want to be a 12-year-old girl again? I mean, I haven't even done it once, and I don't want to do it. But face, you know, and she's coming in to do a violin lesson at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when she should be home sleeping or out in the fields running around having some fun. But here she is, a violin lesson. And I've got to do two things. I've got to build her up emotionally, and I've got to communicate that I love her. Right? So the first thing is I smile. That's the second secret weapon. Got a little bit out of order here, but it doesn't matter. They're kind of mushed together. I have discovered that if you smile at someone and you just beam at them, it's virtually impossible for them not to smile back at you. And even if they can resist the smile, if you keep at it, they'll crack up because they know they're trying to resist, and that's funny in itself. Because you can't say to your 12-year-old girl when you're a 30-year-old guy, "Hi, sweetie, I'm so glad you're here. I really love you." You have to beam at them the smile that lets them know you're glad you're there. And then you start your economic system. And you say, "Wow, that's a nice blouse you've got on." Now, I don't even know what color it is, and I don't think it's nice because I don't look at girls' blouses, but I know she spent 20 minutes figuring out what to wear that day. Right? So I say it. Right? So immediately, one thing. And she comes, open the violin case. I say, "Wow, your violin's so nice and clean. You must have polished it up a bit this week." Maybe she didn't even touch it for the weekend. That's why it's clean, but it is clean. Right? There's another positive. And I would keep score. Now, I'm not talking false praise here. Don't get me wrong. But I would keep score, and I would try to get in 10 positive comments or observations before I would make the first correction. And I would try to keep the ratio high enough. One last story, and we'll wrap it up here. I had the experience when my daughter Fiona, who's now 17, was, I believe she was 8, might have been 10, I can't remember. She was, I was going to fly to Boise. I was in Spokane at the time, and my family was taking me to the airport. I was going to be in Boise for the week. And she was in tears. She's like, "Daddy, you have to leave again. You're always leaving, and I miss you so much when you're gone. And here I am in the airport, and my father's heart is being ripped out, and I'm like, oh, God, I could just cancel this week in Boise." And then I thought, wait a minute, I'll just take her with me. So I said, "Fiona, hold on, let me make a phone call." I made a phone call. I said, "Okay, we'll buy you a ticket. You can come with me to Boise for the week. I got it all arranged. We'll just go to Walmart, buy a toothbrush, some underwear, you'll be fine." Her mother's like, So I took her to Boise. Right? And I put her in my writing class, and she was younger. I think she was 8, because she was younger than everybody, right? And I'm teaching all these kids, like 4th, 5th grade, and she's sitting in. She's over there. She can hardly read, can hardly write, barely copy words, right? And she's sitting over there. And I don't care what she's doing. Why? Because I'm busy teaching everybody else's kids. I'm running the class and all this, and I'm looking, and she's doing something. She's at least sitting there and not making noise. So I'm happy. So the class is over. She goes with the family. I teach a few more classes. I go pick her up at the family's house. We're driving to the hotel. I said, "Fiona, how's your day today?" She goes, "Oh, it was such a wonderful day. They have a lake at their house. It's really cool. And they have these little boats. And we had to push them out on the lake. And one of the boys had this remote control thing." And I said, "Well, how'd you like the writing class?" She goes, "Oh, Daddy, it was wonderful." Real dramatic. And I think, And then she said, "How come you're not like that at home?" And I realized how easy it is to love and be nice and be supportive and be encouraging to other people's children, and how easy it is to forget to have that same niceness, kindness, love, and supportingness to my own children. And ever since that day, I have gone and I have consciously found at least 1 minute every day to take my children one by one aside and look straight into their eyes and say, have I told you how much I appreciate you, your contributions to our family, and how you work hard? I just love you so much. And I will say that. And they kind of laugh because I've done this hundreds, maybe thousands of times. But oddly, they never get tired of it.
Thanks for listening. Do you have questions or comments? Please contact the Institute for Excellence in Writing at 1-800-856-5815 or visit our website, IEW.com.